Okay, welcome folks. Today is Thursday, October 24th, 2013. We're launching the Rules Reasoning LP, which stands for Logic Programming mini-series. Both Benjamin and I will go over some initial slides, and then we'll have opening remarks. So if you want to view the slides currently or download these, start. Okay. The full title is Ontology, Rules, and Logic Programming for Reasoning and Applications. Second slide. The topics we want to address, obviously there's a lot of detail here, so please read and you'll become more familiar with the topics as we go on. We want to address knowledge representation based on classical logic, declarative logic programs, rule log, etc., including standards. We also want to address ontology and rule reasoning systems, requirements, tools, design, implementation, and at least some extent ontology and rule reasoning optimization, and of course applications. Slide three, a couple of main goals. Sketching out the current field of ontology and rule reasoning. This will address standards, but also the technologies themselves, techniques, tools. We also want to address the issues and architectures involved in developing applications that use these technologies, ontology and rule reasoning. And finally, describing visualization explanation technologies for ontology and rule reasoning. Next slide. The mini-series program, currently we have at least five sessions planned, and you'll see these listed numerically with the dates. So today's session, number one, this will be followed next week, October 31st, by Concepts and Foundations of Rules and Ontologies that Harold Bowley and I are chairing. The third session will be on November 21st, the fourth, December 19th, and the final, at least in this planned series so far, January 9th, 2014. Today's agenda, which is the next slide, this is slide five. We introduced this, which is this slide deck. We're going to have opening remarks. Basically, we have to time these fairly closely since we have a number of folks participating with approximately 2 minutes each. That'll be followed by two surveys, tutorials by Benjamin and I, followed by a general question and answering open discussion.
This is Benjamin. I just want to make one comment. You'll notice that when Leo was presenting about, you know, the topic for the mini-series, although the original name was Rule Reasoning and Logic Programming, ontology is in there too, because ontology really cuts across orthogonally. Of course, Ontology Forum is part of, you know, what we're doing here as a context. And just what is the nature of the relationship between ontology in various concept or foundational ways and in various other practical ways, including techniques and applications and tools and systems and requirements and design and implementation, is very much going to be part of the topic of the mini-series. So rather than thinking of ontology and rules as a shorthand, people often treat them as if they're largely disjoint categories. A lot of the focus in this mini-series is going to be on how they come together and how rules can be used for ontologies or logic programming can be used for ontologies.
Okay, thank you, Benjamin. What I'd like to do now is ask Michael to give his talk. Michael?
Okay, thank you, Leo. So I've been working in the area of ontologies for 20 years now, and over that time, I've been a big advocate of some of the more expressive ontology representation languages, first-order logic, common logic, over other languages, say, such as OWL and other description logic-based languages. And one of the reasons I've have taken this position is because I often feel that the intended semantics of a lot of the concepts that we need to cover in their different applications really require that kind of expressiveness. But that kind of leads to two other issues. One, of course, is, well, what are these other applications that we're talking about? A lot of applications you might see on the web are kind of more oriented towards ontology-based search. Other applications related, say, to semantic integration. But there's another big area of application of ontologies that was covered, I guess, a few years ago in one of the ontology summits, which is using ontologies as part of some kind of decision support system. So in other words, using some kind of automated reasoning in order to draw conclusions from the action zero ontology. And so in this sense, we have, even if you have the nicest ontology with the richest set of axioms in a wonderful language, if we don't have the reasoning support, then we can't do anything with this ontology. The ontology is going to be relatively useless to us. And so one of the things I hope to see in this mini-series is ways in which we can unleash the axioms of the ontologies that we have been writing and to really do something with them in various kinds of applications. And the applications I'm specifically thinking of are, again, ones that use automated reasoning. In addition to those kinds of end applications, I think kind of following the topic of this past year's Ontology Summit, which was related to ontology evaluation, I see reasoning playing a really critical role in ontology evaluation. And this goes back to some of the earliest work on competency questions, the idea of you characterize your ontology with respect to some set of queries that it is intended to entail. Again, without a good support for automated reasoning, this methodology falls apart very quickly. And so I'm really looking forward to it. I'm really enthusiastic about this this mini-series, and I say looking for guidance from the reasoning community to help ontology designers to use the available tools to both, I say, to evaluate their ontologies rigorously, as well as to apply their ontologies in new and wonderful ways. And hoping that the ontology community can be providing a lot of test cases, again, in areas either with evaluation or with applications, to really test out the capabilities of some of the tools. And I think one of the really interesting other angles is going to be, with this emphasis on rules, is looking at some of this kind of broader question often of, you know, what is the best ontology language that was the appropriate ontology language, I should say, for you know, either representing my ontology or for using it. And there may often be cases, and this came up in this past year summit, where you may represent your ontology in, say, full first order logic or common logic, yet when you're using it, you might use a subset of that, say, so you'll say a rule subset of that in order to do a particular application. And the relationship, that kind of relationship, is something else also that's really critical to future applications of ontologies. So thank you very much, Leo and Benjamin.
Okay, thank you, Michael. Is Michael Kiefer on yet?
Yeah. So first I would like to thank Leo, you, and Peter, and others who helped organize this mini-series, because I think it's important to sort of start bringing the rule people and LP people together to raise the profile of this technology, because I think we have the best technology for KR, but somehow it's not getting its due in the community. One problem, I think, we had a lot of hopes for Reef when it was being developed, but I think there were problems, systemic problems with the whole process, because of the charter, we could not really produce the dialect of the rule interchange format that are really useful for the rules community. And we had to limit our attention to this basic logic dialect, which is basically data log and not very expressive and useful. So later, we tried to produce more expressive dialects, which use well-founded semantics and others, but this hasn't become a standard. and Benjamin and I were pushing now this rule log dialect, which is what Leora referred to as SILP, but it's sort of cleaner and more expressive than Silk was at the time when the project was terminated. So I would like basically to call people to pay more attention to the standards and help develop better standards. I don't know if W3C is a right avenue for that, right venue for that, because it's not clear if they will be interested in continuing the RIF effort. But we have to think what would be the right venues for developing a really useful dialect for the RULF community and LP community. I also feel that it's somehow fragmented the community. For example, there is an effort to build a rule interchange format for the answer set community, and they are not do not seem to be interested in joining forces with the rest of the world. So they're building kind of a standard just for themselves. So I don't know. Somehow we need to overcome this fragmentation and in order to raise our profile.
Okay, thank you, Michael, for your contributions here, and I hope you can participate in the remainder of these sessions. Leora Morgenstern?
Okay. So this really comes at a great time for me, this mini-series. So I just wanted to speak a little bit about the work that I'm currently doing and talk about how very relevant it is to this integration of ontology and rules. I'm at Leidos, a company that used to be called SAIC. We spun off part of ourselves and renamed ourselves Leidos. Kind of confusing, but anyway, that's my affiliation. And what I'm working on now mostly is an IARPA-funded seedling to see how feasible it is to translate from regulatory text to executable rules. So the idea is to go from really, really tough rules, you know, like looking at financial regulations, for example. That's our test domain. You know, we're actually looking at particular regulations like the Securities and Exchange Act or the Patriot Act or pieces of them or pieces of regulations from the Financial Regulatory Authority. And we're taking this abstruse, complex text and we're turning it into executable rules. So the way that we're doing it is we're first extracting whatever we can in terms of intermediate representations, and we have several intermediate representations, and one of them is as rich an ontology as we can extract from the text. So the idea is to extract this ontology, also to extract a dependency graph of the way rules reference each other and the way rules are and sections of rules are exceptions to other rules, as well as templates. We're using not just syntactic parsing but semantic parsing, because as we've been what we've been doing is classifying our the regulatory paragraphs in the documents in various ways, and it's clear that the kind of rules you'll have in a penalty regulation are different, for example, from those you'll have in a permission or an obligation. So we're looking at semantic, how we can use semantic parsing and assignment of roles in order to help us with that. So those are the three intermediate representations that we're using, and we're then going to be mapping this onto executable rules. So the question is, well, what sort of executable rules are we using? I wish Michael Kiefer were here, but at least Benjamin is here to hear this. You know, so the original idea was, well, you know, use a kind of standard like RIF, but it became clear after, you know, just a cursory look at many of the rules that something like RIF is clearly inadequate because it's just not expressive enough. And in particular, as you start looking at the rules, you realize that exceptions are such a fundamental concept. This is why I mentioned the dependency graph that we're extracting from text as a first step. And you need something that's rich and that supports reasoning with exceptions. It supports giving priorities to certain types of exceptions. And all of this is available in a language like SILP, which is what we're now agitating to have SILP as the language of choice for executable rules. But the point really is that the integration between the ontology and the creation of rules and the reasoning mechanism, and all three of these are needed in order to get where we want to get. So we're not just interested in having a set of executable rules, but obviously we're interested in reasoning them, and in particular to look at a particular at some situation and determine whether or not the agents involved and the people involved, the organizations involved, whatever you want to call it, if they're compliant with a particular regulation, whether that's a permission, a prohibition, or an obligation. There's you know, compliance can be reasoned about in all of those cases. So this is what we're looking at. So it's the integration of that's really interesting, and I'm hoping to find out a lot about this during this mini series.
Thank you very much, Leora. Is Vinay present yet?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay, Vinay. And I just want to remind people that if you're on the bridge, also try to get onto the chat. Join us there, and you can provide comments. Just another reminder that we're trying to approximately shoot for about 2 minutes or so per speaker on these opening remarks. Thank you. Vinay.
So I'm going to speak from the perspective of somebody who has been a power user of representational languages and has built applications using these languages. I haven't counted, but I think I've used more than a dozen different representation systems that have been built by the reasoning community over the years. And I have quite a bit of experience actually using these systems and applying them to real problems to build systems. So that's the perspective I'm taking in making my remarks. So the first thing I wanted to say was that the distinction between the rules and ontologies, I find it artificial because from a purely logical point of view, you can take an ontology and you can translate it into a rule language. And So the question is, you know, what's really the big fuss about? You know, under the hood, system could do whatever it wants. It can use a rule language or ontology language or whatever. Why do we even need to make a distinction? And as an application developer, I feel that, you know, an application developer shouldn't have to worry or know about the difference. But if you think about this from a computational perspective, the major ontology language that we have today, OWL, comes from the description logic tradition, and that community has focused primarily on decidable reasoning. And in the rule languages, the decidability has not been a driving factor. You know, people have focused more on, okay, I want to make my language as expressive as I can. I don't really care about decidability. So it seems to me that the focus of discussion should not be on rule versus ontologies, but you know, how do we achieve decidable reasoning? And you know, some people dismiss this goal of decidability reasoning, but you know, I also happen to have some background in database systems, and when you're building a database system, the performance guarantees and termination guarantees on your programs is very crucial. So I don't think the computational properties of a language can be simply dismissed, and I feel that at least folks who have been focused primarily on rule languages have not really paid much attention to the decidability aspects of their languages. So the second point is, I think there is also this continuum between rules and ontologies versus conceptual models, and I think that primarily stems from knowledge acquisition. And, you know, a lot of these languages in the ontology world, they originated from people building user interfaces. You know, you build a user interface, you have to show a taxonomy and you have to show connections. You know, semantic nets kind of had a graphical way of displaying knowledge. And, I mean, there is really, really a continuum. And to me, it seems that from the knowledge acquisition point of view, what you really need are conceptual models which really hide the logical intricacy or the quantifiers or all these concepts like negation as failure or negation. These are the things that users find, at least the end users, not the logic trained people. People who don't have much training in logic, they find it very difficult to use. And it seems to me that there has to be some focus on designing representation at the conceptual modeling level, which mirror your knowledge acquisition interface. And finally, to me, again, as an application developer, what I want is not a language that has all the features. That's really the wrong focus. And every application has a certain need. And for that particular application, you have to pick a language which has a tasteful combination of features. I mean, you definitely, if you're trying to put every imaginable feature in that language, that's not the language I want as an application developer, because a lot of those features are not very useful to me. Okay? So that's the end of my remarks.
Okay. Thank you, Vinay. Harold, are you present and
yes,
unmuted?
This is Roland Allen opening remarks. Joint work with Adrian Paschke and Tara Essen. So, slide one. So we often talk about ontology and rules, and how do formal ontology relate to formal rules? If you look here, the first bullet, ontology in the sense of description logic intersected with rules in the sense of data log would yield description logic programs, which are used in AL2RL. In the second bullet, if you intersect ontology rules first order logic with rules in Horn logic, you get Horn logic rules. And finally, if you intersect ontology FOL with rules RuleML, you get ontology FOL. I want to make a point about this in the next slide. So slide two shows the RuleML family of sub-languages. The left branch, you can immediately go to the FOL part under deliberation, but you can go upward. You can go to higher order logic and model logic. We heard earlier about the need for model logics like permission obligation and so on. But you can also go into the right main branch of RuleML for reaction rules, active rules, which are no longer FOL. So, slide three. The RuleML family of sublanguages covers a wide spectrum, as I mentioned, but the point is that you share across the spectrum the condition part of rules. And you also get a syntactic uniformity which enables further reuse. The family now constitutes a deep sublanguage lattice with major sublanguages in an inclusion path. For instance, starting at deliberation, go down to higher order FOL, derivation, Horn log, and data log, where some of the features are being mixed in. For instance, negation as failure, which leads to logic programming. Slide four. In particular, let's have another look at the reaction rule ML, part of this family, where we branch into active databases, production rule systems, rule-based event notification systems, KR event action transition process logic systems. And here's another connection also shown with ontologies. For instance, at the bottom of this slide four, you see spatial and action ontologies underneath temporal event ontology, situation ontology, process ontology, agent ontology. Coming to slide five, endorsement and support, it is crucial for the ontology community at this point to connect web rule ontology efforts across academia, standards bodies, and industry. This rules reasoning and deep collaboration of Ontolog with RuleML and others will foster and enhance these connections. So this mini series of Ontolog is a big step for our networked community of communities.
Okay, thank you, Harold. Our next speaker, Hansen Graves. Hansen?
I'm going to simply talk to what Ken and I were particularly interested in. I can't get to my slides, but one aspect of this whole miniseries is really to look at reasoning system applications, both things that have and things that we think could be done. So we're really interested in realistic use cases of how well various kind of, let's say, logic-based system rules or whatever deal with these cases. And the interest is really towards industrial strength use cases rather than just academic exercise. So, of course, any experience reports are welcome, but we're also particularly interested in future applications, that is, places where we see the potentiality of reasoning really being helpful, that is, in bringing tangible benefits in industry of one sort or another, where this hasn't happened yet, but trying to understand better what the opportunity is and what the preconditions for success might be. That's a particular interest of mine, having come out of, you know, a product development background, and I know or can see cases where it really could be helpful, but you just have to look at what it would take to make it happen. So that's, and I think Ken may be saying something of the same in this regard. So I think right now that's all I've got to say.
Thank you, Henson. Ken McCloskey?
Yeah, I basically concur with what Henson said. If you go to the slide I wrote up, I basically just said, you know, let's look at examples of successful and unsuccessful uses of rules and reasoning and find out what we can learn about them. I mean, what are there, is it conceivable that we could come up with industry best practices? You know, can we get a list of lessons that have been learned in different industries? It would be really helpful in one industry to look at what worked and didn't work in other industries as they move forward to the use of rules and reasoning. And you know, there are many examples where rules and inference are being used today. In some cases, I don't think our communities are very well connected with these other communities. Well, of course, there's the database community that has constraints and triggers. I mean, what was good about that? The programming language community has a notion of type inference. It's actually quite interesting. I don't think too many people in our community have looked at that. There are, of course, many business rule engines. I think those are really quite sophisticated. They're, I think it's very successful in that industry. Also in the military and medical settings, you find situational awareness, which also involves rules. And even in military, of course, there's this notion of rules of engagement, which you sometimes hear about in the news media. So all of these are areas that we might, you know, look at, see what worked, what didn't work, what are the lessons that we could learn. Okay, thank you very much.
Okay, thank you, Ken. John, so I know we have a slide set for him, but...
Yes, coming up. Okay. I'd like to emphasize some points about vague, incomplete, uncertain, and context-dependent information. And my slide number 2, which says model theoretic semantics, emphasizes the difference between the model theory that's commonly used in logic as the foundation for determining truth and falsity and natural languages. And in the center, there's an abstract model, a set theoretic model, and on the left is a picture of the world. Now, the point I want to make is that when you evaluate the denotation of statements in a theory in terms of a model, you get truth or falsity as your denotation. But no model is perfect. Every model is an approximation to the world, and for different purposes, you're going to have very different kinds of mappings, and those mappings will definitely not be precise formal mappings. And summary that engineers use is all models are wrong, but some are useful. Now, Wittgenstein, in his first book, had the assumption that is the foundation for model theoretic semantics, and that is the world is everything that is the case, that your model and your world are identical. That is definitely not true in natural languages. And there's another 10 slides that follow, which I would ask you to browse through, and it covers a lot more detail about how the world maps to and from language and any particular theory of ontology. So I'll let you go and read all these things yourself. But the point I want to make is that the mapping is by no means a simple, precise one with a fixed set of word senses which map to a fixed set of predicates which map to anything resembling these very clean model theoretic kinds of assumptions.
Thank you, John. Remotely, John recorded his because he could not be present, his remarks. Mike Dean?
Yes, I don't have any slides, but I wanted to take a moment to say that I'm delighted to see this miniseries as another collaboration opportunity between the ontology rules and logic programming communities, which unfortunately have been largely disjoint despite many common goals, as a number of the previous speakers have noted. So I look forward to the rest of the series.
So let me just tee things up while Leo's gathering himself there for a moment. Peter, I think you had a few opening remarks. Do you want to cover those?
I really appreciate all the effort that has gone into preparing and organizing this mini-series. I believe this is a very important next step in our collaboration effort to bring ontology and semantic technologies to the communities and their collaborators. And we are actually expanding from the usual conversation topics, going from ontology to application of ontology a bit more, going from just ontologists and ontology engineers talking to each other to trying to include system engineers and applications developers. I mean, something we've been trying, but this will be sort of more concerted effort. Also going from classical logics to non-monotonic logics, divisible logics, and so on, and going from formal ontologists to maybe including in our conversation semantic web researchers and implementers, system modelers, and so on. And all in all, I think more so realizing the original ontolog mission of discussing actually practical issues and strategies associated with the development and applications of ontologies, and to strive to advance the field of ontological engineering and semantic technologies to help move that into the mainstream. So my kudos to those who are contributing, and they are really making a major contribution to the body of knowledge that this community has been collaboratively building since we came together in 2002. Let's expand from just the research and the science into including the engineering and solving real-life problems. So, back to Neil.
Thank you, Peter.
So we're going to, this is Benjamin, we're going to move on to the next major phase of the presentations here. There are four main decks overall, though there were some sub-decks of the remarks by some of the individual speakers that we just heard. So next, what we're going to do is have some survey by Leo.
Okay, good. I will do an introductory survey on some of these technologies, and then Benjamin will follow. We have limited time, so we may have to accelerate a bit. If you bring up the slides, the survey title is Logic Programming Ontology Rules, basically the things we're addressing in this mini-series. Slide two, what I'd like to cover, and some of this will be too simple for many of you and possibly even too complicated for others. But I mean to just give a brief overview of some of these technologies and formalisms and issues. So logic, both propositional and predicate logic, logic programming, ontology, specifically as a logical theory about the world, ontology reasoning and rules, and a brief final couple of slides on issues like decidability and complexity, which I think Benjamin will get into in more detail. Slide three, of course, what is logic? Here we're focusing on deductive formal logic, and as a formal language, which has a formal syntax and semantics. And we're interested because we can represent our knowledge in these logics. And, of course, then machines can interpret these, an inference engine, and then perform automated inference. Think of these as proofs using inference rules. And much the same inferences that humans make. So that's the value, ultimately, of these technologies. Slide four. Just a very quick overview, propositional logic. So, again, it's a language, has a syntax and a semantics. Typically, we define a set of symbols, logical constants, variables, and operators. So they have their own, if you will, vocabularies. The constants, true or false, and variables are propositional symbols. And, of course, the typical logical operators or connectives. It also has formulas, which you can think of these as well-formed formulas. We'll call these propositions. Any propositional symbol is a well-formed formula. And, of course, this is defined recursively for more complex representations or expressions that, in turn, are propositions, well-formed formulas. So the if you will, the following are well-formed formulas, things such as just P, not P, this disjunction P and Q, or the conjunction P and Q, etc. And very simple examples at the bottom, propositions in English structured in terms of a modus ponens, an inference rule to provide a conclusion. So John, if John is a management employee, then John manages an organization. John is a management employee, therefore we can conclude that John manages an organization. We still are not addressing semantics per se here yet. This is roughly the syntax. Next slide, five. Within logic, we differentiate proof theory, which mostly focused on the syntax, and model theory, which is focused on the semantics. So John Sola mentioned model theory. The proof theory is really addressing the deductive apparatus of the language, and you can think of these the proof theory as consisting of the axioms, the rules of inference, and theorems. So think of a rule of inference. We've just seen one such as modus ponens. In general, this is called a syntactic consequence. It's a consequence relation from premises conclude the conclusion or the consequence. We deal with formal models, which is a model of the formula of the language, is an interpretation of that language for which the formula comes out true. So that's the proposition. Model theory, the theory of interpretations. So we talk about logical validity, which is the double turnstile there, which means, you know, a formula is logically valid if it's true for every interpretation. And, of course, semantic consequence makes that a little more complex, meaning that beta, for example, is a semantic consequence of alpha. If there's no interpretation for which alpha is true and beta is false. Slide six, just a very quick notion of the interpretation. It's an assignment of meanings to the symbols and or formulas of the language. And, of course, we have the usual very elementary truth table, which is the formulas with respect to their truth values, and then we can compute that, for example, two formulas are equivalent by checking their truth values. And, of course, it becomes more complicated in predicate calculus. Let's shift to seven, slide seven. Just some more English examples, one demonstrating invalid conclusion and one a valid conclusion. If the implication, which is the conditional, if pigs can fly, then dogs can talk. If we structure this in terms of, let's say, a quasi-modus ponens, if we try to conclude if pigs can fly, then dogs can talk, and pigs can't fly, we really invalidly conclude dogs can't talk. So it's an invalid conclusion. However, we can conclude if pigs can fly, then dogs can talk, and dogs can't talk, we can conclude pigs can't fly because the inference rule is a valid inference rule called modus tollens, and you can think of obviously inference rules as validated patterns for deriving conclusions from premises. Next slide, eight. Shifting a bit to predicate logic, we introduce predicates, individuals, and quantifiers. And again, this is there's other complications, such you may have a modal predicate logic, which we won't get into. And with some examples, both in English and a little more formally on the right, side by side. So as you can see, looking at the right, we've introduced from the simple propositions the individuals that we can assert things such as if P of X, then Q of X. So, and then P of an individual named John, so X is a variable, but John is a constant, an individual constant. We can conclude that, in fact, Q of John, which is John manages an organization. Again, this is modus ponens. What this is trying to show you in this survey is really just the kinds of rules and the apparatus that we use in logic for valid conclusions. The next slide, slide nine. The semantics of predicate calculus is really a generalization from those truth tables. So you think of originally from Tarski, you're talking truth with respect to a model. And model theory is what it typically addresses the semantics of logic and other languages, including English. So you evaluate, so semantic evaluation is generalized. And it basically focuses on the interpretation function, mapping of symbols of the language into the model domain, the bindings of the variables, and again, you know, determining the semantics, if you will, of more complex expressions inductively. So some call this constructive semantics or compositional semantics. Slide 10. Now we shift into logic programming in this whirlwind tour. Logic programming has some good properties, and which we can't address in detail here, but things such as the Liebig-Herbrand model, six-point characterization, goal-directed proof procedures, and some of these make a clear and complete operational semantics with a clear and complete operational semantics linked to its declarative semantics to be a real programming language. We talk about Horn formulas, and we'll see a couple more in the next couple of slides, so I won't focus on that now. In what we call Horn clauses, Horn formula, Horn logic, a polynomial time algorithm for example, Horn satisfiability, negation as failure, we'll mention that again. But it's also the case that Prolog, for example, can have a a quasi-classical negation. Next slide, 11. Some of the fundamentals of prologue, again, horn clauses, horn rules. We'll see some examples. Also, the notion of substitution of information and unification of information, basically computing compatible information as the prologue, for example, a program is executing. It tries to find unify information to make it compatible with existing information. Uses resolution theorem proving, which really goes back to Robinson, who discovered this inference rule and demonstrated its efficiency. By default, it's a depth-first proving search strategy, but you can obviously modify it. Prolog itself is Turing complete, and you can create meta-interpreters that basically want to do what you want it to do. There's implicit quantification. Universals are implicit in the rules, and you can also have existentials. And in recent years, of course, there's been advances in Prolog to include things such as disjunction and other extensions. We also can use, for example, in not just Prolog, but most theorem provers, a form of scolemization that in effect substitutes for existential quantification. By eliminating quantifier and normalizing with either Scolem constants or functions. Slide 12. Prolog is mostly a declarative language, but it does have procedural operational semantics. The operational semantics, a number of these are things such as the cut operator, which enables a human to that understands the domain and the application of the rule to, in effect, kind of hack to prevent search and re-execution of portions of rules. Negation, it uses negation as finite failure, so if something is not found in the knowledge base, assert it's not the case. This is not true logical negation, but Prolog has this, in addition to at least much of database technology. It is order dependent, so the order of the facts and the rules will be crucial. There are other forms of logic programming which are maybe perhaps more declarative, such as answer set programming, where you don't have the order requirement. Prolog and most logic programming languages assume the closed world assumption, but there are extensions such as stable model semantics and well-founded semantics, which gives you a form of true logical or strong negation. And of course, some such as answer set programming, you can use both kinds of negation. 13. I mentioned that we have facts and rules, and these are, think of these as just the facts as instantiated relations, and the rules as think of them again as terms of for example, modus ponens. Inference rule, where you have a head and the body of the clause. And we can differentiate that with respect to logic, but they're pretty closely related. The structures that we've given you are called horn clauses, horn rules. There's additional definitions, but we'll move on. Slide 14. Many of you have seen this slide, so I'm not going to focus on this. We're mostly interested here in the logical theory, which is the most expressive, if you will, notion of ontology. most expressive meaning and strongest semantics, meaning richer semantics. 15, we view ontology as a logical theory. As a logical theory, it contains the axioms, inference rules, theorems, and theory notions from logic. It's just that ontology is really kind of a non-logical constants and properties because it's about the world, specific domain. So 16, Nicola Guarino's original picture of how an ontology acts to constrain the set of models to closer to the intended models. Given a language in which you the ontology is represented, and the conceptualization you have of the world that begins that you begin with. Next slide, 17, is just a graphical view of the axioms, theorem, theory. Think of the theorems as being added to this once proven to the increasing theory. Slide 18, it just gives you some textual representations in a, let's say, a typical ontology for axioms, maybe some of the inference rules you'll use, and some specific theorems. The next slide, I just wanted to mention that we are typically dealing with three levels, the language level, knowledge representation level at the top, the ontology generic description level, and the instance level at the bottom, where the knowledge base is. Slide 20, just some examples of classes, instances, relations, properties, values, and rules in a electronic commerce domain. Slide 21, we're also focusing on upper middle domain ontologies. Many of the domain ontologies are created for specific application areas. To help us organize and establish common classes, relations, properties, we use typically foundational ontologies, which are upper and middle ontologies. Slide 22 basically structures that those levels a little bit differently. This is borrowed from Harry and Loeb, which is showing that mathematics and logic really ground the at the top ground the constructs we use when we were dealing with ontologies, and of course a final epistemological data layer, which is where the evidence comes from for individuals, for example. 23, in the interest of time, we're just showing that that is going to, the next slide, next couple of slides will focus on the logic spectrum, which is a subset of this ontology spectrum. So 24, we show kind of the increasing expressivity of the logics from the lower left to the upper right, propositional logic up to second order, higher order logics with some way stations such as logic programming, description logics in between. Slide 25 describes some of the other kinds of, first of all, the notions that each logic realm, if you will, provides. In addition to the constructs below it. So description logics may be a decidable fragment of first-order logic, et cetera. One thing we're not focusing on is substructural logics. But if you look at 26, there's other things that we're not directly addressing here, like non-classical logics and probabilistic logics. 27 just simply maps some of the languages. This is mostly AL1, but also common logic against these types of logics. And then 28, This is derived from the original rule ML diagram of the types of rules that we want to address. The rule ML itself has evolved and will be addressed later in the standard section, primarily Harold Bowley, etc. But you can think of these as the kinds of rules that usually go under the rubric of rules, most of which we address with ontologies to some extent. 29, I'll skip good and bad and ugly types of rules. And rapidly approaching the end here, the expressivity slide 30, you have to wonder what you want to do with the language you're using for your ontology. So building an ontology in a knowledge base, but maybe you also want to do consistency checking. This addresses the type of reasoning you want to do, querying, but also kinds of inference. Maybe you want to do abduction and probabilistic reasoning. 31, negation is an issue, which Benjamin will talk about in more detail following this. 32 and 33, then some of the literature in tractability, complexity. This is focusing more on descriptive complexity, which is a fairly recent branch, if you will, that tries to address the complexity in terms of the language that expresses the description. So in slide 33 is Immerman's basically diagram of the kinds of languages and their complexity, showing essentially what we think of are the most tractable languages, at least, you know, prior to quantum computation, for example. Okay, and then the final slide here, 34, is just some of the formal properties. You can refer to this later. And then 35, Benjamin will start his briefing. Thank you all. Benjamin?
Okay, thanks a lot, Leo. Leo, you covered a lot of ground. Quite the tour there. Okay, slide one. Aiming here to do a fairly high-level survey, a couple of prefatory remarks. This is going to be fairly abstract, not so many examples. Just trying to get across a few, you know, points about a few key areas. There's much, much more detail available in a tutorial that I and Michael Kiefer and Mike Dean have been giving for almost a decade at various conferences, semantic web, web, and AI conferences, and there's a pointer to that at the end of this deck. Okay, slide two. So I think it's important, especially for people who are primarily familiar with or have a mindset that revolves around classical logic, to understand the more general definition of a knowledge representation or a logic. So this may seem elementary, but I found in practice it's quite important to grasp the following structure. So knowledge representation we'll define here as a triple of a formal language for specifying sets of assertions. Each assertion is a statement. A second formal language for specifying sets of conclusions, which are also statements. And these two languages, while they coincide in classical logic and certain other logics that are inspired by classical logic, such as modal logics, it is not in general the case that one is even a subset of the other. So, for example, in declarative logic programs, some of the conclusions cannot be stated as assertions. Some of the assertions cannot be stated as conclusions, right? So there is non-overlap in both directions in declarative logic programs, which is what I'll refer to as LP throughout the rest of this deck. Whereas in first-order logic, more generally higher-order logic, classical logic, and some of these other logics, they are the same languages. We'll write the entailment relation with turnstile. And turnstile here basically means that what appears on the right-hand side here, A turnstile C, C is sanctioned as a legit conclusion from the set of assertions A. and then we'll write the set of conclusions from a particular set of assertions in a particular knowledge representation system F. Now, typically, entailment is defined formally in terms of models, that is, truth assignments that satisfy the premises and meet other criteria. Some people who are classical zealots claim that the notion of model theory in LP is not really models, by which I would restate that as, it's not the notion of model theory that people coming from class, some people coming from classical logic most like and enjoy. So that's just something to be aware. You know, Leo covered some of the basics. As I said, there's much more detail available in that long tutorial if you want to get into details. But I think it's a very important point to grasp that the style of model theory in LP, while it bears a relationship, a close relationship to that of used in FOL, is somewhat different. Just as was the case when model theory for modal logics was developed, it's close, but it's not quite the same notion of model theory. All right, so what are some example knowledge representations? Relational databases. People often don't think of databases as a knowledge representation, but really they are. So relational algebra, a la SQL, is essentially a subkind of LP. In particular, it lacks logical functions. It focuses largely in practice on the Horn case, although it also uses negation as failure pretty heavily. So you have the complement or kind of subtract operation in relational algebra. So LP was actually the logic that was developed to formalize relational databases and also pure Prolog and then theoretically unify them. Certain issues arose there, which took a number of years to resolve, but have been pretty much settled at the model theoretical and kind of basic theoretical level overall since 1994. There's been a pretty settled constructive semantics for LP. Now, of course, another example KR is classical logic. Most people learn that in school. So they may not know it under that name, but that's the logic they've learned. That when they think of logic, they often consciously or subconsciously think of that. Now, in computer science, that's typically used in program verification and planning, but of course it's used more generally as the foundation for mathematics. Therefore, the terms in which a lot of other knowledge representations are described at a meta level when describing the characteristics of the KR to other researchers. Other types of KRs include rules and various flavors, and a central abstraction there is LP. Most people, unfortunately, even most computer scientists, do not learn LP in school. The closest is that a lot of people, when they learn databases, they're learning something similar to LP, but it's not, I mean, they're essentially learning LP, but it is not presented in nearly as general terms, and focuses not on chaining in LP, but rather just directly answering a query against facts, where you have essentially one big rule, which is the query, being evaluated against a bunch of facts. Now, a key extension of LP is RULOG. We'll come back to that. I just want to point also the June 20th session of Ontolog Forum that I presented went into quite a bit of detail about RULOG, and there's much more about it in that tutorial I mentioned, the long tutorial. Now, there are many other example KRs, Bayesian probabilistic networks, what's called probabilistic logic programs, Markov logic networks, fuzzy logic, various kinds of approaches to inductive, possibilistic, et cetera, temporal logic, of course, description logic, as well as modal logic, which are, very inspired by classical, and answer set programs, which is another extension of LP besides RULOG, which is kind of intermediate between well-founded logic programs and classical logic in terms of its behavior. And we'll have more discussion later in the mini-series about ASP, as answer set programs are known. Okay, so here we come to a key point. What are ontology and rule in general? Ontology...
What slide are we on?
Oh, sorry, slide 4. Thank you, Peter. Slide 4. ontology is not disjoint from rule. Best way to think about it, it's a view that is kind of an orthogonal dimension in KR space. It's really a purpose for knowledge. And ontology, when one speaks of a particular body of knowledge or a conceptualization or a vocabulary, is best thought of as a subset of an overall body of knowledge. And the key there is that it's definitional in flavor. A key aspect within that is terminology. So, for example, lions are a subcategory within felines, or a healthcare visit has a required copayment amount, can be viewed as defining terminology and nonsensicality or sensicality, the complement of nonsensicality. Like, it makes sense to talk about a copayment if you're talking about a healthcare visit. A rule is an if-then logical implication, and a fact is a special case of a rule. So an example would be during the mitosis phase of an animal cell cycle, all that cell's DNA is replicated. Or AAA members get a weekend discount of 20% on suites at a particular hotel chain. Now, they may not be directly stated as here's the if part and there's the then part, but something that is in pretty close hailing distance to be put into that form. And that includes an enormous fraction, arguably almost all of, ontological knowledge. So just, I want to beat that point home. Most ontological knowledge can be viewed as rules. Vice versa, almost any kind of rules or other logical knowledge can be viewed as consisting of definitions and thus be regarded as ontological in a sense. So in particular, if you have a concept or a relation or an expression and you're viewing it in terms of necessary and sufficient conditions for when that concept, relation, or expression is true or false. So for example, the field of concept learning as it was conceptualized in the 1980s in AI, in empirical inductive techniques, is all about arriving at such necessary and sufficient conditions for a concept that you're labeling exemplars with respect to, and then attempting to predict the labeling in or out for that concept as you see more instances of that describe attributes for that instance. And again, I want to beat this home. Rules and ontologies are overlapping, not disjoint in general. Now, some KRs are aimed at particular kinds of ontological knowledge, for example, description logic. And as shorthand, knowledge specified in such a KR has often been called an ontology. Yet much of this knowledge may be facts rather than definitions. As I mentioned, much of it may be viewable or implemented as rules. So that can lead to confusion. And I think there's been plenty of confusion. In fact, part of the separateness of the communities has, I think, been caused by some of that confusion at a high conceptual level. Now, two common kinds, moving on to slide 5, of ontological knowledge are formalized vocabulary and schemas of databases or other kinds of information models, particularly in common software engineering practice, those are object-oriented. And those two kinds of ontological knowledge, vocab and schemas, overlap in general. One basic kind of formalized vocabulary that most people in this analog forum community are familiar with is where you have a list of categories or classes, a hierarchy among them, a list of properties, restrictions on the domain and range of those properties, some basic meta properties of those properties, such as reflexivity, symmetry, and transitivity, and disjointness or equivalence statements about various pairs of classes or various pairs of properties. Now, description logic is aimed at ontological knowledge, overlaps largely with that basic subkind of formalized vocabulary, as does RDF schema, and is the basis in terms of formal logic for OWL and RDF schema, which is simpler, basically, than OWL, and is good for representing many kinds of formalized vocabularies or schemas, and some kinds of categorization or classification and configuration tasks are done via reasoners that only support description logic. However, description logic is severely limited in important ways, both for ontological modeling and for integration with other kinds of KR about rules. There's a need for other kinds of ontologies besides OWL. I've got a long list here. I'm not going to go into that here except just to point out you can browse this at your leisure. Moving on, that was slide 6. Moving on to slide 7. Here is a key slide. So when you come from mathematics, when you come from OWL, when you come from the way people are educated in the foundations of computer science in terms of theory of automata and program verification, for example, which is a basic topic that's usually covered in the undergrad or first-year grad curriculum, you start from the viewpoint that the core KR is classical logic. So I'm going to state it in a very dramatic way. Wrong. Practically. In practice, LP, not classical logic, is the core KR of structured knowledge management today. So the core KR that, you know, is used far more than everything else put together is databases. So there's more information, more instances of that information in formalized form in databases there is in other kinds of logical KR. So whether it's relational, as we'll regard as kind of the beginning, although there were kinds of databases before that, or semi-structured, a la XQuery, or RDF, so Sparkle, which is also semi-structured, or what's called object-oriented databases, which is the abstraction that XML and RDF started from in terms of database theory. Every fact, query, and view is essentially a rule. So relational databases were essentially the first successful semantic technology, and LP was the KR, the logic that was invented to formalize them. Now, business rules evolved into their current main commercially used form, the commercially dominant kinds, which we'll cover on the next slide. I'm not going to that yet, though. Have pretty much the same expressiveness as databases. Very high overlap. So I'll cover that more in a moment. But they also date from the same era, roughly 30 years ago is when they got going commercially. Now, there's newer fangled stuff. It started in the late 90s, and is the basis for much of semantic web and semantic technology community, which are semantic rules and semantic ontologies. So there, the main focus of the rule ML standards design of SWRL and the basis for RIF has been LP and the very closely related fragment of classical logic, HornLog, Horn FOL. Especially function-free Horn FOL is often used in practice, and that was the basis for SWRL. RIF focused its charter on Horn, primarily as far as fleshing out specific dialects. A tool that corresponds roughly to that expressiveness that's fairly clean and open source is Jenna, for example. A key extension there of such semantic rules is RuleLog, which was prototyped in a series of advances, going through RuleML, the DAML, the DARPA agent markup language effort, the WSML effort, web services markup language, the semantic web services framework, earlier work at places like IBM, more recently at Vulkan and the Silk system, and now at Coherent Knowledge Systems with RuleLog. Psyche is closely related to RuleLog. It's by far closer to RuleLog than it is to LP or classical logic, for example. So this is state-of-the-art as far as available expressiveness in the LP family. And as I said, you know, reflects a series of advances stretching back over the last, 15 years or so. Now, maybe 20, arguably, because there was Flora developed, the Flora system, I should mention, which is very important, Flora and Flora 2. Now, in the semantic ontologies area, there's RDF schema and OWL. The most important used fragment of AL is the rule subset. There are some of the other fragments, EL and QL, which are also closely related to LP. So if we think in terms of the analogy people often use in economics, LP is the 99%, classical logic is the 1%. The semantic web today, as far as its practical reasoning mechanisms, is mainly based on LPKR. Even though some of the formal specs are done in FOL, it's essentially insofar as they overlap with LP that they are actually implemented. And that goes, for example, for OWL, and it goes for RIF. Moving on to slide 8, what are these commercially dominant legacy kinds of business rules? Well, there's production rules, there's event condition action rules, and there also is Prolog, which is much, much smaller as a fragment of overall market IT spend than production and ECA rules. LP is the core KR basis for all three of these insofar as they are semantic, that is declarative, but each of them are only partially semantic. Moving on to slide 9. So we can kind of summarize the scene in terms of things that are defined formally in terms of LP logic program family versus in terms of classical logic. I've listed a bunch here. There are some logical framework standards and designs, notably RULML, which then a RIF framework for logic dialects were based on. Moving on to slide 10. However, some of those standards that are defined in classical logic, RDF, RDFS, OWL-RL, RIF, BLD, and CORE, are essentially very closely related to, most of their expressiveness overlaps with LP, and are typically implemented using LP techniques. Classical logic, slide 11, the fully general case is higher order logic. There, a predicate or a logical function itself can be a term, not just a constant. So it could be a variable or even a complex term. And its generality makes it very difficult to automate fully. It's closely related to set theory, some of the paradoxes and power and difficulty there. So used in computer science much more than HOL is FOL, where there is that restriction that most of the people in this community are familiar with, that a predicate or function must be a constant, and that's much more amenable to automation than higher order. That's used especially, as I mentioned before, in program verification, also planning and scheduling, where you use constraint satisfaction techniques. And classical logic, a fragment of first order, essentially, is description logic, which is really a subfamily, and there's a particular one used in OWL. And this restricts the patterns of variable appearances in certain ways. That's the most essential way to think about its further restriction relative to first order. It also lacks logical functions. Now, the logic program family, the core abstraction there is what is called normal logic programs. When it was introduced, it was sometimes called general logic programs, which is a terrible name because there are now things that are more general than that. But that was to distinguish it from Horn originally. But a better way to talk about it nowadays is normal LP. And the rule syntax is that you have a head, which is an atom. You have a conjunction of atoms and negated atoms in the body where the form of negation used is negation is failure and behaves non-monotonically. Intuitively, you can think of NAF as meaning not believe BI. Now, when it was originally introduced, it was defined in terms of essentially a procedural mechanism, but then in the following 15 years, it was given a very rigorous semantics, and it's defined constructively in the well-founded semantics, which is the typically used one, which behaves better computationally, as an iterated fixed-point construction with three truth values, true, false in the NAF sense, and an intermediate truth value between true and false in the NAF sense. This intermediate third truth value is called undefined, or sometimes U for short, and it was introduced to be able to represent certain cases of paradoxicality, loops through negation as failure, of recursive dependence through rules. But I think the most easy way to think about that conceptually is just paradoxicality. So you can say things like, this statement is false. What is the truth or falseness of that statement itself. RULOG extends normal LP and adds several expressive features, several aspects of meta-knowledge in particular. HiLog, which is kind of higher order on the cheap, higher order syntax with a well-defined semantics that reduces to first order. Reification, which is closely related, where any formula, not just a literal, can be treated as a term. Defeasibility, where rules can have exceptions. Along with that is a stronger form of negation, so you're reasoning about both the pro and con side of a formula or a predicate or an atom or a literal. And that behaves non-monotonically, of course, and going with that are priorities. Then rule IDs, which enable meta-statements about assertions, including for provenance, and is used in defeasibility, for example, a talk about cancellation or prioritization. And restraint, which is the new kid on the block here, or the newest kid on the block, which is a form of bounded rationality that uses the undefined truth value for some other purposes, such as don't want to bother past here or can't get that info. Another important type of expressive feature that's in RULOG that extends beyond normal LP is omniformity, that is classical-looking formulas that can appear in the head and body, in particular that in the head you can have a somewhat weak form of disjunction that still doesn't get you into reasoning by cases, and you can treat existentials essentially via scolemization. Moving on to slide 13, there are some important restrictions that apply not just to classical logic, but also to LP and RULOG and many other KRs. So HiLog is an important extension of first order, as I mentioned. It is used in common logic. You have a transformation that reduces essentially HiLog syntax to regular first order without blowing things up computationally. And it's also used in RULOG in a very similar style to common logic. It was pioneered in some work by Chen, Kiefer, and Warren, implemented in the Flora system, a number of other systems, including classical systems before the common logic standard was settled upon. So it's a fairly mature idea, but most people have not learned it as part of their KR education, and I just want to hammer home that's a really important one to understand. We're going to have some coverage of that in the next session of Ontolog Forum. I'll be presenting some about that. And Michael Kiefer, who invented, is a great expert and resource on this. Of course, then there's first order, then there's Horn, in which at most one literal is positive. That's the point of departure for normal LP and OWL, as well as databases, RIF, basic logic dialect, and an RDF schema. There's function-free, which is used in databases, and also in RIF core and OWL and RDF, although RDF has a kind of form of scolemization, which you can think of as a bit of functions. Finally, there's the propositional restriction, which Leo covered, which can be viewed as arity being zero, and that's used heavily in techniques and constraint satisfaction. Moving on to slide 14, part of the motivation for why people focus on particular fragments of overall ideal expressiveness is due to computational complexity. So on this slide is a summary of the computational complexity. I'm just going to hit a few high points here, but I encourage you to really absorb this because this is really important stuff for everyone to know, every single point on this slide. So if we view N as the size of an initial set of assertions, just kind of syntactic encoding of that, you would like your inferencing task to be tractable, not just decidable. Databases are tractable, not just decidable. Horn LP is, in the propositional, the ground case, is linear. If you're function-free, it's polynomial. If, as is typical in practice, the number of distinct variables per rule, say appearing in a query in SQL or Sparkle, is constant. That's called the bounded number of variables restriction. Then normal LP without logical functions, which is what databases basically do a large fragment of, and what business rule systems do a large fragment of, is polynomial. However, FOL in the propositional case even is not, due to reasoning by cases with disjunctions. So three sets, one of the original NP complete problems. FOL is undecidable. you get blow up due to recursion through functions. The same thing happens in normal LP once you have functions, and indeed actually just even without negation is failure in the Horn case. Rulog is polynomial if, as is typical in practice for Rulog, one employs the feature called restraint, which essentially says don't bother past a certain frontier of depth, in a certain sense of depth, of syntactic scope and associated semantic scope. And you can, what's cool about this is even with functions and a bunch of other features, high log, defeasibility, et cetera, that extend LP, you get this polynomiality. And as I mentioned, that leverages this undefined truth value. Moving on to slide 15, again, something that is very important for everyone to understand in this space is a fundamental theorem that connects Horn LP to Horn FOL. Horn LP entails the same set of ground atomic conclusions as this Horn FOL. So Horn LP in general is sound but incomplete with respect to Horn FOL. Usually you don't care much about the ways in which it's incomplete. That's why earlier I talked about these arrows of kind of things defined in FOL formally are essentially mostly captured using LP and implemented in practice using the LP techniques. The stuff that's in Horn FOL that's not in Horn LP includes stuff like non-unit derived clauses and tautologies. OLRL practical reasoning is thus essentially LP, for example, Oracle's implementation, which is one of the first major commercial implementations of OLRL, and ditto RDFS. Rulog, there's an associated generalization, is sound but incomplete with respect to high-log FOL. Common logic is high-log FOL. So Rulog is sound but incomplete with respect to common logic. Certain restrictions apply. There's some theoretical work in progress about that. This insight is relatively immature as foundational theory goes, having only been come up with within the last decade, as opposed to the other stuff I've talked about, which dates back several decades. Rulog lacks reasoning by cases. Essentially, it has the power of the unit resolution proof strategy in FOL resolution. However, in the presence of conflict, it's usefully selective, unlike classical logic, including high log FOL and common logic, where any conflict of an inconsistency type results in all senses being concluded, i.e. garbage. So to recap, there are these, moving on to slide 16, there are these things defined in terms of classical logic, but you can largely view them in terms of the LP family, especially when you move to Rulog, as I mentioned with some of these arrow relationships earlier. For more info, you can find this AAAI 13 rules tutorial online. Here is the reference. And this has been a tutorial that has worked well for audiences similar to Ontolog Forum over the last decade. A book is in early stages of prep based on it, but a draft of that is not available and will probably not be for another 6 to 12 months minimum. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Benjamin. The remaining time here, folks, we'd like to focus on questions and answers. So this is open up to the participants. If you have questions or comments, please raise your hand in the chat room, and we'll call on you, and you can address anyone or anything that you want to. If you had a comment in chat that you'd like to mention or talk about or question one of the speakers about, please raise your hand. Well, I'll start us off. Hassan made a comment late in the chat about a couple of other languages that have been developed that have comparable properties. Hassan, did you want to talk about that at all?
Okay. Well, all of these presentations were very interesting, but at least from my standpoint, I think a bit biased in the sense that they ignored a whole lot of very interesting rule-based contributions in computer science for the past 20 at least years. And as in terms of notions of rules, I think one fundamental rule system that has been around for a much longer time is simply the lambda calculus, where essentially a function is described as a rule that has a very simple computation based on beta reduction, which is essentially a functional call. Now, this is an important body of work that has been completely occulted in what I've seen, and this has been also the basis for very important, as a matter of fact, the first work on higher order logic programming pioneered by Gérard Huet that essentially solved the higher order unification problem in his 1976 thesis, then taken by Dale Miller and Gopalan Nadatil to define a very important higher order logic language called Lambda Prolog that has now a pretty efficient and quite pragmatic implementation by Gopalan Nadatil and his students at University of Minnesota called Tejas. And in addition to everything that we've heard, a very important aspect of logic programming, at least from my standpoint, and I guess I'll elaborate that whenever I have a chance to participate, is operational implementation. Because in all these logics, it's very fine and dandy to have modus ponens, whatever rule that you want to have. But when it gets to being used, you have to worry about very important pragmatic details. How are you going to run and how efficient are you going to run? Now, Prolog is based on what most people know, which is essentially the Warren Abstract Machine, which is a way to see Prolog and unification as essentially an assembly language. Now, this also joins the way the lambda calculus itself is implemented, because the lambda calculus, when implemented, is implemented also in a sort of assembly language. And there are other sorts of rules that also are implemented using this kind of technology. And I think it's important in this mini-series that we should look at this level of details, because if all of this technology can be made practical, it's the onus is on us, computer scientists, to show how it can be executed very efficiently. So this is essentially what I wanted to say. And another thing that hasn't been, well, it's been mentioned, it's all the work on constraint logic programming that abstracts, so it takes Prolog and abstracts unification as one particular constraint solving, essentially solving algebraic equations in the first order theory, to anything that can be represented as a constraint solving. Now, this is very important because it gives Prolog a much much bigger power, the Pro technology, much bigger power, and that also opens the logic programming paradigm to anything that you can represent as a constraint-solving process, including fuzzy, probabilistic, whatever. Okay, so I think also that part should be emphasized as, in my opinion, a very promising means to make the logic programming plus ontology or whatever become a reality.
Thank you. Peter?
Yes.
Actually, this is Benjamin. I just want to say, Hassan, can you please put in the chat the references that you mentioned that are not already there, like that 76 PhD work on the higher order programming? This is Benjamin. I just wanted to say thanks very much for the comments. It's hard to cover everything in limited time and also limited knowledge. I agree that I think the implementation techniques are very important. A key thing in the modern Prolog technologies now and LP technologies, besides the WAM, the Warren Abstract Machine, is tabling, which is a form of keeping work around from caching work on subgoals and the results thereon. And, you know, that would be good to spend some time at some point in an ideal mini-series talking about as well. I think constrained LP, it's not well understood what the right way to sort of map it against expressively from a logical viewpoint. All the other stuff is here as a kind of a hybrid system, but I agree that it is quite an important practical mechanism that does give Prolog technology more power. I think you put that very well, Hassan. Thanks a lot.
Yeah,
those are just some remarks in response. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, if I can answer quickly, I earlier in the chat I gave the website for the Tejas system in University of Minnesota, and there you will find all the references for Jean-Huet's thesis and all that.
Okay, great. Thanks a lot.
Okay, it's already there. And as far as constraint logic programming, I guess I'll have time to elaborate. And I agree with you that we don't have time to cover everything, but I just wanted to just add a little pepper on the meal here to say that we're just at the tip of an iceberg, and there is a need to be systematic in covering all these approaches rather than just saying, oh, there's this idea and so on, without reinventing a square wheel. So what I would like to do is essentially point out all this work that has been done, not so much to praise it or hail it or whatever, just to add to the bag of knowledge that we should have. Because what I've seen in the little time I spent with all this semantic web effort is that there's a whole new generation that is not very educated in logic programming in general, and that tends to ignore all these things. And it's, I guess, we're responsible somehow to provide pointers to what has been done and to make it available without undue difficulty.
Thanks a lot, Hassan. I think we need to move on to other people. Peter, I think you were going to say something.
Yes, a couple of administrative comments first. Those people whose names are not recognizable for the interest of attribution, please sort of morph into your full name, first name, last name, upper camel case. If possible, that saves me a little bit of
work. Okay, let's take additional comments. Thanks a lot, Peter.
Yeah. No, I have a comment,
Go ahead.
On Leo's presentation, I guess when you got to slide number 26, you did mention that we're not covering probabilistic logic, substructural logics, and so on. When you say we there, are you talking about, I mean, classical logic people, or are you talking about this mini-series, or what was...
No, no, I was talking about my slide set. It's too much to cover.
Oh, I see.
I would like to, but I think it's fair ground for our series, some of the probabilistic extensions, for example.
Thank you. I just wanted to make sure I heard you right.
Sure.
Thank you.
Looks like Joel.
Yeah, can you hear me?
Yes.
I'm as a budding ontologist, I'm trying to wrap my head around some of these things that are in Rule ML, and I'm sort of getting hung up on making the bridge between things that are represented in XML schema and other kinds of descriptions of ontologies that are more like FOF or RDFS. Is there a description of the pieces of Rule ML that can help me move out of the XML world and into the RDF world?
Let's see. Harold, maybe you want to respond to that? Is Harold still on?
Yeah, so there is a new way to use XML in RuneML. We have two kinds of element tags. Some are called edges, which leads to nodes. So it's like Stripe syntax, and it's a kind of object-oriented use of XML that is able to bridge between the worlds of RDF and XML. So I can point you also to some pages in the conversation.
Okay, if you could post some links to that in the chat room, then I'll pick it up in the transcript. Thank you very much.
Okay, you do.
Okay, this is Benjamin. I just want to add to that. I mean, what Harold said at the beginning, it was broken up, I think is a key point, which is that there's a close relationship but not identicality between the fundamental data model of XML and that of RDF. So you can, you know, they're both based essentially on this notion of semi-structured data that was developed in the database community, as well as, you know, RDF, of course, was conceptualized in the era of markup. So ideally they would have been done as one spec together. This issue of how to bridge back and forth specifically for RuneML has been, you know, there's been considerable work on that in the past. So there is lots to look at and to understand there, but is it as neat a story as one would like? No, and partly that's due to the fundamentals of XML and RDF, and partly it's because I think just articulating what those relations, that set of relationships is sort of an ongoing effort for the last number of years.
Okay, because I'm trying to figure out how to reference those ways in the ontologies, you know, it reference the concepts that seem to be very well defined in RuneML in a way that would fit into an ontology that I'm writing in OWL. And I'm not finding an easy way to know how to do that. So.
Yeah,
okay,
yeah. In a sense, RuneML requires a binding and some logic, right? This is more to Harold and Benjamin.
Well, let me take first crack at that. I think there's two aspects. One is the data model, and the other is just the logic, which is really what I was focusing on in my survey presentation, because I think that all too often people jump into trying to think about it in terms of the data model, bypassing, think about it at the level of the logic or the KR and the semantics thereof, or without understanding some of the basic relationships in terms of what's essential, what's inessential in the syntax of KR. So I just encourage you also, when you look at these issues specifically for moving back and forth, say, between XML and ontological representation or ontological knowledge in RDF, to think about it at the logical level, not just the data model or the markup kind of syntactic level.
Okay, good. Thank you. Let's see. We're getting close on time here. I see that Alex had a question, if he's still around, in the chat room. Alex, did you want to raise this with somebody in particular?
Oh, great. I was just trying to get a sense of some of the temporal components that might be present in a ontology construction for implementing some kind of a dynamic process that's changing over time. And I didn't hear a lot of that. So if the logic program itself or some of the logic models change over time, how is that handled practically?
Does anyone in particular want to address this? I would say that in ontology, we can you can use a temporal logic or an interval logic, but you can also specify, you know, an ontology of time, for example, and use that directly, but perhaps that's not what you mean.
Well, yes. I mean, that's where I'm going with this, but I don't know exactly how to map one to the other and what that does to the logic programming model, if you will, in general.
Okay, this is Benjamin. Let me take a second crack at that to complement Leo's. I think there's a lot of confusion about the relationship of time to logic. Most temporal knowledge and reasoning you want to deal with can be described if one is working with a suitably expressive generic logic that doesn't specifically have time-specific features built into it, such as common logic or rule log or whatever. You can just do that using the general logic. Now, one of the difficulties in classical logic is how to represent change of state in a reasonably terse way and also do it efficiently, computationally. And there, the use of non-classical logics, which are non-monotonic and can represent things like, you know, frame axiom or causality and so on, and have the basic mechanism of defeasibility, is extremely useful and called for. So practically speaking, I would say that is a really important point to keep in mind. If you're working with time and changes, how things change in time and reasoning about that, you very, very often want to work with a logic that has defeasibility so you can represent causal evolutions and projection, either forward in time or backward in time, for example, in learning or abduction.
Okay. Okay, that's very helpful. Thank you.
Okay, we'll be continuing this series. In fact, next Thursday, the 31st, we'll have the second session. So if you want to raise your question in the future or you think about it after the fact, please join us for the rest of this mini-series. If there are no more questions or comments, I'd like to thank everyone for participating. Thank Benjamin for his contribution and the initial speakers for their overview and perspectives, and all of you for participating, and Peter for organizing. Thanks again, folks, and goodbye.
Thank you. Great session. Bye.